It's time to catch the beat for Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign, and Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Featuring three floors of gently used books, greeting cards, journals, and more. Jane Addams Bookshop is at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign, online at Jane Addams, that's A-D-D-A-M-S, books.com. As always on WEFT, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I'm honored to welcome to Catch the Beat Casey Robards, an artist and impresario conductor, producer, music director, pianist, vocal coach, collaborator, and recording artist through a wide range of genres that you carry all around the world, much focused on different forms of opera. And this summer, you're traveling and performing intensely. At the moment, preparing for a performance of Lee Hoiby's opera Bon Appetit at the Bayview Festival in Michigan. This is an 18-minute opera with its central character, the classic chef Julia Child. And in August, you'll be conducting Mascagni's Italian opera Pagliacci on Mackinac Island in Michigan. You've stretched the scope of opera to collaborate on an Afro-surrealist rock opera, Water Riot in Beta. And at home, you are a professor of lyric theater at the University of Illinois. And where I encountered you was a panel discussion you moderated around a fascinating collaboration called Mother Tongue, Lived Experiences in Asian America, that blends poetry and voice in a song cycle titled Rituals for Belonging. But Casey, you can do a much better job at describing the scope of your life and your work in music than I will. So how would you like to introduce yourself and what you're most engaged in at this moment in a long and varied career?
Thank you so much, Cope. That's such a generous introduction. And if I could sum up what I am most interested in doing as a musician, that is to both educate and inform, and ultimately to change an audience. At this point in my performing life, I do almost everything in collaboration with others, which is a real passion of mine. I like to work in teams. I like to see everyone using their expertise and putting it together in a way that makes something larger than we could do by ourselves. And I like to do projects that have a strong message, and especially to share stories that may not be widely known or celebrated. Any way that I can uplift stories of people and overcoming obstacles, I like to do so in a way that encourages others to also dream and pursue their passions and sometimes just hang in there. So this recent project, the Mother Tongue Recital, which happened in Urbana in March, was the brainchild of a soprano. Her name is Jennifer Lien, and she's based in Duluth, Minnesota. I saw Jennifer sing three song cycles by Asian American female composers, Justine Chen, Kamala Sankaram, and Melissa Dunphy. And when I saw Jennifer give this recital in Cincinnati, we were part of the Cincinnati Song Initiative a couple years ago, I knew I wanted to bring this recital to Illinois in some way. And Jennifer has a very, very giving spirit. She was performing this recital with many different pianists around the country and agreed to come to Illinois and to perform with me. We were actually the last stop on her tour. So over a two-year period, she sang in many cities, from California to Minnesota to the East Coast. And as we wrapped up in Illinois, we made a whole experience out of this recital that I called Rituals for Belonging. Now, this title came from an art installation that Myung Sung Kim, who is Toronto-based Korean-Canadian visual artist, a project that she created over several years, in which she invited people to write rituals for belonging that they would submit to this group project. And she had crafted these ceramic vessels, which she would gift to an artist or gift to a writer or gift to a friend. And in exchange, they would write this ritual for belonging. And when I first saw this exhibit, I was so moved. I mean, in fact, I almost turned into a puddle of tears just sitting there reading all of these note cards. And I thought, gosh, this is having such a profound effect on me right now. I think I was responding to the fact that people were taking very seriously the cultivation of their own healing and wholeness and well-being, and thinking deeply about how they have experienced community in the world. And as they were sharing these kinds of stories, you know, some of them were had to do with memories or with prayer or with nature. Some were quite humorous. One said, "Gather 2,000 people and do the electric slide." Step one, step two, step three. And so we brought a version of that project to the Mother Tongue recital. Now, the Mother Tongue, we write this as M capital O, THER TONGUE, lived experiences in Asian America. So we're acknowledging the fact that often we are otherized, or as Asians in the United States of America, we have not always felt welcome or been welcome from a legal standpoint. Sometimes just the question, where are you from? I mean, where are you really from? Or where are you originally from? I mean, everyone assumes that we're not from America, and many of us were actually born here. But even those of us who are not, that have US citizenship or that have lived in this country for a long time, don't want to just automatically, you know, have an assumption made that we are foreigners. It really does something to you after a while to always be placed in a category that so quote unquote doesn't belong. So anyway, the O, the capital O in mother tongue, is to give reference to that we're trying to reclaim this and say, no, actually, our mother tongue may be from somewhere else. It may be here. English may be our first language. But what are the lived experiences of many Asian Americans? So, as we were putting this recital together, I wanted to make the entire recital experience like a ritual for belonging. So, as folks entered the lobby, Sarah Park Dahlen, who is a professor at the University of Illinois, she specializes in adoption literature and Asian American literature, and curated a beautiful book table, two book tables for us, one of children's literature and one of adult literature or literature for anyone, all featuring Asian American female protagonists. So as our audience entered, they were able to browse these titles and see these beautiful books and witness the Rituals for Belonging project, and then come into the recital space and feel like, you know, we're creating our own ritual as we are here at this concert. So we read some of the rituals in between the song cycles as a way of connecting to the next cycle. And the themes that we explored in the cycles were everything from our relationship with our mother, who may be an immigrant to the country, and that language barrier. If my mother spoke English in a more advanced way, you know, what would we talk about? Would we joke about the same things? Would we understand the same things? Some of the storytelling had to do with admiration for our grandparents, connection that we saw in our family. Some of it had to do with microaggressions that we experience. And one of the cycles, in fact, was about the willow pattern china that is actually a knockoff of Chinese porcelain techniques. And so, turned into a mass-produced British set of chinaware or set of plates and dishes and things with the blue, the very familiar blue and white printing. But the image on the plate is actually just a made-up folk kind of story. It's not real at all. And so one of the songs talks about, what the legend is on the plate, sea plate. And it's actually nothing real at all. And in fact, I was just in a friend's house yesterday and they had the full set of plates. My father-in-law had the set of plates. So, and I didn't know the full story behind it until actually getting into this song cycle. Well, I've given a very long answer, Cope,
Well,
to
but
your introductory question, but you can chop that up how you wish.
you're telling a story that very much encompasses the kind of work that you've been focusing on. Let's go back a ways. When and how in your life did music come to be your chosen expression for what you wanted to do in the world?
I came about it very early. In a way, it was somewhat happenstance, and in a way, I think it was fated from the very beginning that I was destined to be a musician. Now, I didn't know that a person could be a professional musician. I didn't know that existed until I was actually quite a bit older, at least that I really thought about the fact that maybe I could do that. But I started playing the piano when I was 4 years old. I had a toy piano, a little plastic piano that looked like a real piano, but it was about, 2 feet off the ground and had probably an octave and a half. And I was playing cartoon songs on it, like da 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 ya da 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 da. That's Popeye the
I remember
Man.
that.
Yes, toot toot. Remember the smoking the pipe and all that. Anyway, my mother said, "We need to get you lessons." And I was only 4 at the time, and the local piano teacher said, "Well, I don't teach 4-year-olds," but my mother pressed her to say, "Why don't you at least meet her?" And I was already reading books and things like that, and I could sit still for that long of a time. And so she did accept me as a student. And so I started reading music really right away. I realized later how unconventional my childhood was in relation to music because my parents never told me to practice. And I was like a moth to a flame. I mean, I couldn't stay away. Every time I would pass our little upright piano on the way to my bedroom, I would stop and play, is what my mom would say. I sight read everything. I read the whole book, if I had a book of TV songs or hymns or pop tunes, songs from Annie, I played and sang those over and over. I became a church pianist when I was in, I think, 7th or 8th grade. In my little town in Illinois, there were not apparently that many pianists in town, so they hired a 12-year-old,
Wow.
11-year-old, or whatever I was. But I could do it, and so I started playing for the choir, and I started playing for the services, and I played for the high school musicals and choir and all of that when I was in school. So by the time I got to college, I really had done a lot of accompanying already. For me, music was a very personal expression. It was an outlet. It was really a language. It was a way that I could say things that I really couldn't say out loud. I was adopted. I was born in Korea and adopted at perhaps 7 or 8 months years old. I'm not exactly sure my real birth date. I mean, I have a date, but I don't know if that's really real. And so for me, I could put a lot of what I was experiencing and feeling into music. I think things that I didn't even have language for. Coupled with the fact that I was used to playing with other people, the choir or with solo and ensemble contest and things like that, I had a very sort of natural on-ramp toward collaborative piano and accompanying and that sort of thing. So it took me until I was about 25 to really realize and own and understand that through and through I was a musician, and that my main joy and ability really coincided in collaborative piano. Of course, I went to the University of Illinois as a student. I was a piano performance major at first, so I played a lot of solo things. I played concerti and all of those things. But when I realized that, a person could have a career in music and making music, it was very logical for me to go into a collaborative piano, which then turned into vocal coaching. And then much later has now turned into some conducting.
How have you shaped the work that you've wanted to be involved in bringing into being? You've done so much. You've done opera. You've done a lot of recording with vocalists. How has that developed over your career? And it's interesting to me that you're a professor in lyric theater, not in music. So you really, performance is your chosen direction.
Yes, those of us in lyric theater at the University of Illinois all are coming from music backgrounds, and it's just that we're putting the music that we make into the context of theater and of dramatic productions and things like that. But we're basically housed in the School of Music or School of Music and find our work and our identity there. A lot of it revolves around relationships. The friendships and working relationships that I have with colleagues through the years is a large part of how I decide, should I go here or should I go there? Often it's what I can do with my friends. The other thing I think that is a through line for me is I like to do things that I've never done before. I like to try new things. I like to push into different genres and kinds of experiences. Maybe it's a little bit because of how I grew up. I always grew up playing popular music. I was always very interested in jazz. For many years in Urbana, I played with gospel choirs and sang in gospel choirs, and the University of Illinois Black Chorus was a huge influence, as well as my time at Canaan Missionary Baptist Church. But I've played in Broadway shows. I was actually a bass player in a rock band up in Michigan for a few
Were
years.
you?
We did covers of 70s and 80s, 90s music. So I'm just very interested in many different styles of music. I think as much just because it's fun, but I also am always curious about how different musicians think about music in different ways. I mean, even just an oboist versus a soprano versus a trumpet player or a percussionist, they're all thinking about music in slightly different ways based on the repertoire, based on if they're doing chamber music, if we're doing orchestra, if we're doing opera. I find all of those little nuances to be profoundly interesting. I, in many ways, have a very open-ended approach to the kinds of projects that I may be involved in, but I also, want to see an underlying purpose in the messages that we're sharing and in the kinds of stories that we're telling. I think there's a lot to be said for doing something very well, doing something very intentionally with a high degree of polish and all of the training that we can bring to it, years of learning how to put all the elements together. And sometimes that includes improvisation and things that are very spur of the moment, but they're coming out of a contextual understanding that you may not have as a beginner to a genre or to a style. But after soaking in it, after experiencing the culture and the way of thinking about something, it's just amazing what can come about with like-minded musicians. And I'm interested though in pushing the boundaries or crossing the boundaries, maybe bringing different things together under one umbrella, things that may not necessarily touch one another on their own. For example, in the mother tongue music, to say, can we bring some Indian raga into this art song way of delivery? Years ago, I had the good fortune to play a recital in Carnegie Hall, and the program that the singer and I brought there was all popular music, all top 40 hits, but sung in art song style. So we did Frank Sinatra, we did Maroon 5, John Legend, John Mayer, Elvis. Lots of different kinds of songs that were all hit songs. We started with Schubert, but we wanted to bring an art song kind of approach to these lyrics and to these melodies. And we had fun doing it. It's something that we were experimenting with. I like those kinds of cultural overlays. Another project that myself and many others in Urbana were involved in January 2026 was to make a recording of the opera An American Dream by Jack Perla, and Jessica Murphy Moo wrote the libretto. This opera is a 70-minute one-act opera that premiered with Seattle Opera and has seen, I believe, 14 or 15 different productions around the world, but this was the first commercial recording that was created of the opera. And so we're going to be releasing it in April of 2027. And this story explores the relationship between a Japanese woman and a German woman. The German woman is escaping from Nazi Germany and had to leave her mother behind. She and her American husband end up in Puget Sound. The husband purchases a house that belonged to this Japanese family that was being sent to an internment camp. The Japanese mother, father, and daughter, as they go to the camp, the daughter hides one of her dolls in the floorboards of the house. They were supposed to get rid of all objects that made them Japanese. Anyway, they were sent to the camps, and years later, the daughter returns to the house because she had stolen a letter that belonged to the German woman. And the letter actually reveals what happened to the German wife's mother. So, the German woman and the Japanese daughter have this interaction. But it's a dark story. It's a hard story to hear and watch. It's beautiful music. And I love how it explores this idea of home, who gets to be American, and why and when, and how easy or hard is that to do. How are we all connected to each other in these stories of how we came here or how we're trying to live here? Incredible displacement that people live with and have experienced and are still just trying to make a home. We were really excited to put this opera into a nice recorded format. We recorded it right there at Krannert in Fullinger Great Hall.
Well, it's a recording studio.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a lot of fun. And we are hoping to bring this into more live performances in several cities this next year.
What about teaching? What place does teaching play in your creative life?
It's a huge part of what I do. I have been teaching at the collegiate level since 2008, and I've been involved in several different institutions. I've also taught at the Bayview Music Festival for many, many years. I love the interaction with students, particularly those who are trying to make their way potentially as a professional musician. I work primarily with singers and pianists, but I also work with instrumentalists of all kinds. I am so grateful to the mentors and role models and instructors that I have had. And this classical music art form exists in that very old school apprenticeship model where we sit one-on-one often with a teacher over several weeks and months and years, and those relationships that are forged can be quite influential. And then sometimes we have just one-time encounters with someone in a master class for 10 minutes or 20 minutes, and that can also be very transformative. So I love to try to share and impart and model and just also be alongside young musicians. What they are trying to do is not easy, it has the potential for being rewarding for their entire lifetime. So any energy they put into it is a worthwhile pursuit, and the deep engagement that they can bring, bringing themselves to this art, is exacting, but also such a wonderful thing to experience. We almost have a chance to be like Olympic athletes or something like that, where, not everyone can experience what it feels like to be in that kind of zone, or, to have trained on something for so long and have it be a language that you can manipulate and work with, and then do it with other people. But the hours and hours and hours that go into it cannot be underestimated. I mean, there are no shortcuts for making this kind of music.
Here's a question I ask for my creative interviewees. Do you have a regular practice to keep your personal creative life fresh and growing?
I am learning more about how to really value my creative energy. I want to give a shout out to a woman on the internet, Kenning Zhu, Zhu, Kenning. I have enjoyed her podcast about being a creative person, and I realized that it's something to nourish and cherish and protect and make space for. So I'm finding that all the ways that I can stay as healthy as possible. Right now I'm trying to get my blood sugar into under control. I had no idea it was even an issue until recently. But just maintaining health and balance as much as I can. I do live at a pretty helter-skelter pace. The summers for me are a little bit less so, but when I say the things that I'm doing to someone else, they say, well, that's not a rest at all. So I find that I have a capacity to fit quite a lot of things in, and I try to maintain my own sense of recovery. The variety of projects that I'm involved in, I think, helps with my stamina in a funny way.
Yeah. Casey, I want to thank you very much for spending time with Catch the Beat while you're in Michigan and a very busy performance schedule. And I look forward to your work in Urbana and to getting better acquainted with your music.
Thank you so much, Cope. Wishing all your listeners well.
I give thanks to Casey Robards, professor of lyric theater at the University of Illinois, for sharing a bit of her life as an accomplished pianist, conductor, vocal coach, and above all, collaborator who has brought fascinating music to our community. You can read more about her work and what performances are coming up at her website, www.caseyrobards.com. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Jane Addams Bookshop at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign, online at janeaddamsbooks.com. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. You can also listen to live stream and archive shows on the WEFT app, available on your favorite app store. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.